presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, Tillis Powell, and Dennis Norden. Here's round one, which sets a certain test to their vocabulary. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. Anne Scott James, what's the meaning of licit? L-I-C-I-T, licit.
Well, I suppose it's the opposite of illicit.
Yes, meaning?
That which is allowed, it's allowable.
Two marks it is. Legal, permissible, not illicit, on the same principle of not actually disgruntled. He was far from being gruntled. It's the same sort of idea. Now, Frank Muir. Frank, what is a galopade? G-A-L-L-O-P and then A-D-E. Galopade.
A galopade? Ooh, it's a drink. But it tastes of horses. Hooves.
Sounds absolutely revolting. You better try again. But lay off the drink.
We think it might be a dance by part of the Spanish school, where they make horses dance.
That's a very good shot.
Well, take it then. Accept it in your target, sir.
Yes, but
it's one of those awful things they make horses do in sort of...
That's perfectly right, yeah. But is it only dance by horses?
No, of course not. Oh. Otherwise you wouldn't have asked the question.
Galopade is a lively dance, originally Hungarian, though it's a French word, but... Dennis Powell is quite right. In the business of making horses do strange things, which they call manège, it's a sidelong or curvetting kind of gallop. Dennis Powell, what is a tawse? T-A-W-S-E.
Ooh.
And some people would say, what are tawse, if that helps at all?
It's a thing you throw, isn't it? Kind of a game.
That's a caber.
That's a caper, is it? Oh, tawse.
Is it a whacker?
Yes, it's a
whacker.
It's a whacker.
Anne was making whacking gestures. I deduced.
The way I feel.
it's a kind of part of a cat of nine tails.
It's jolly good. And a tawse is a slit leather thong, used to be used, and I think I should probably get frightful trouble for this. I think it's still used in some Scottish schools for chastising children.
Yes.
And it's made of leather, and it has thongs at the end rather than a cane. And in Scotland, it's the tawse, which is plural. And with us, I think it's normally singular. Now, Dennis Norden, what's the meaning of disembosom? It's embosom. Embosom.
I get words like that on radio. Well, it means what it says. It means to get off your bosom. get off your chest.
But
to make a clean breast off.
Oh, that's better. All right, you've won, Dennis. You've got poem, all right. To disclose or reveal, or it can be used intransitively, to unburden oneself or to make confidences. In fact, to get it off your chest. I mean,
why
Dennis is quite right.
Here?
I don't know.
Two marks.
Oh, thank you.
Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the two women members of the teams to go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, actions speak louder than words, and Dennis Brown and Frank, yours is, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And then at the end of the whole program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. And so to round two, and these are odds and ends of Greek mythology, two marks for correct answers. Anne Scott James, who was Ares and why was he mocked?
He was the god of war.
Yes, and how did he get into a mocked situation?
What did he do?
Ares... or Mars.
Did Cupid come into it?
Yes, he does. Afterwards.
How long last?
It was
9 months.
Don't
you?
Well, he must have had a fling with somebody.
Yes. Call him Mars and see if you can get it right. Isn't very
with
easy.
Venus.
Yes, all right.
Or Aphrodite, let's just say, isn't so sticking to
But
the
why language. Was he mocked?
I think he must have undressed backwards or something.
No, it's not. Nothing.
They overlooked?
Yes.
Nothing. Who saw? Yes. Somebody saw them. Cupid must have seen them.
No, Cupid wasn't there.
Oh, who can have watched them?
Ares was the Greek god of war, equivalent of the Roman god Mars. He was fairly unsuccessful in the Trojan War because he backed the losing side, and not at all successful really in his love life. But he had this very long affair with Aphrodite or Venus. There were 4 sons and a daughter, and he included Eros among them. And he was caught with her in bed by her husband, who was Hephaestus, or as the Romans said, Vulcan, who invented a special net which closed over the unfortunate pair to imprison them. And then he invited all his pals, all the other gods on Olympus, to come and laugh at them. So that was why he was mocked. Thank you. Who in Greek mythology were Alecto, Megara, and Tisiphone?
Ice skaters, were they? Tri-Furies.
Yes.
Tri being three. the three Furies.
That's absolutely right. What did they do?
What? What have they got me a mouth?
They pursued Orestes and other people.
Yes, they did.
They pursued Orestes among other people. In other words, not alone.
I think only Orestes at that particular moment. But never mind. I think with the help of your partner, you'll get your 2 words.
That is, Jack.
These were the avenging deities. They were known as the Furies, but they were also called the Eumenides, and I'll explain that for a moment. And they were the goddesses who carried out the curses which were deserved by criminals and who tortured the guilty with stings of conscience and other punishments, both in this life and in the next one. And they were called Eumenides, which meant the kindly ones. So frightened often they don't name them by their proper name. And partly because the punishment of evildoers secured that the good people were in a reasonable state. And the three of them were Alecto, and she's the one who rests not, and Megara, who is the jealous one, and Tisiphone, who is the avenger of murder. They're a fairly tough lot. They had snakes in their hair and all sorts of things like that. Tell us, Power, what did Acis and Pygmalion both have in common?
Oh, now they both...
statues.
Yes, made statues.
No, they didn't both make statues.
One of them did, yes.
Half
a mile.
Think of it and think of the new.
Pygmalion did. Isis was...
Helen mixed up with...
Galatea.
Yeah. Isis and Pygmalion had in common the fact that they both had a lady love called Galatea, that it wasn't the same girl. Isis was a Sicilian shepherd, and a very nasty chap with one eye called Polyphemus, lusted after this particular sea nymph girlfriend, and very unkindly, he crushed Acis with a very large rock. So that was goodbye to Acis. Pygmalion, who was king of Cyprus, made the statue which we referred to, called it Galatea, which means the milk-white woman, fell in love with it, brought it to life, and they lived happily ever after. So they both had the same name, girlfriend. Too much. And Dennis Norton, who was the Greek god of commerce, cunning, and inventions? He was a son of Zeus, and he invented the lyre, L-Y-R-E.
I keep seeing them all like ministers, you know. I'm the god of cunning and inventions, and he sends a sort of memo to
Hermes.
Please expedite love filter to goddess of love. You know, they're like ministries, aren't they?
That's right. He was the messenger of the gods, so he probably would have done that too. Much the same messenger of the gods. And he invented the lyre by placing strings across the shell of a tortoise, and he did that pretty early in life. He was born in the morning, and he'd invented the lyre by midday. And by evening, he'd stolen 50 head of cattle and hidden them in a cave. And then he went back quietly to his cradle. He was quite a chap. Well, next round is a round of grand questions. Again, 2 marks. And Scott James, what was the grand tour?
Oh, the Grand Tour, I think, started in the 18th century, didn't it?
Mm-hmm, roughly.
And the sons of the rich used to be educated by sending them round Europe, which Italy was a sort of high spot.
Yes,
France was included.
That's all right. It was part of the education of those young Englishmen whose parents could afford it at the end of their schooling to send them on a tour of the main cities and artistic centres of Europe, and especially, I suppose, France and Italy, sometimes further afield still. Too much. Frank, now, what exactly are Grand Prix races?
Motor car races.
Yes.
Exactly what they are.
And they distinguish
a curved course.
And they distinguish themselves
from
others.
They can return to the starting place.
They distinguish themselves from other motor races.
Is it because they make the drivers or the winners eligible for points towards the World Championship?
Yes, that's right. Quite right. And do yes, I want to know what kind of cars and how many races.
That's a supplementary question. It's about eight, isn't it?
Getting quite close to it.
12.
9. Split the difference.
18. 10.
Well, I don't know how to mark it. 1.5, I think. Grand Prix races are automobile races for single-seater Formula One cars. And if you ask me what Formula One means, I don't know, because it gets altered almost every year. But they're the fastest of the lot. And there are 10 of these country. There are 10 different countries concerned. And as you said quite rightly, points gained count towards the World Championship for both the drivers and for the chaps who make the motor cars. Dennis Powell, what's the Grand Corniche?
The Grand Corniche is a bit of France, I think. Is it France?
Yes,
it's France. It's a great, great sort of curving road which runs round the cliffs above the sea in the Mediterranean.
It's the highest one. There's a couple of other corniches or shelves.
Yes. Oh, that'll do. That's good. Well done. 2 marks.
Thank you, sir.
It's the highest of the three mountain roads from Nice to Montauban on the French Riviera, and there is down at the bottom a coastal corniche, and in the middle, a middle or moyenne corniche. This is the top one. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, who was the grand old man?
The grand old man is... Was it Gladstone?
Gladstone,
yes. Yes, Gladstone.
Mm. Right, 2 marks it is. Either the grand old man or the initials, G-O-M, used in lots of newspapers to denote W.E. Gladstone. Apparently Lord Rosebery is supposed first of all to have called him this, and he did go on to live until the age of 89. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks and Scott James, can you give me the origin of the quotation, actions speak louder than words?
Well, I can only say I think it must be a proverb.
Date?
17th century, I should think.
1 out of 2. This appears to be a proverb, which is very recent indeed. Apparently it's a 20th century proverb. And the best source that is found for it, a chap in 1906 called Mr. McCullough, who wrote a novel with the Cossacks. And talks about the gallant foe who could not quell them, how he sympathized with them, but as far as anybody knows, this appears to be about the first time the proverb turned up. Well, now, Dennis Powell, the origin of yours, please, which was, if at first you don't succeed, try again.
It wasn't the spider.
Wasn't the spider.
No. Bruce was a ventriloquist.
Well, I always thought it was Robert Bruce's remark after watching the spider climbing up his little self-made ladder.
No, I find it very difficult to mark you on this one.
Well, you shall scream yourself, Jack, and
I think 1 out of 2 again, because Bruce and the spider is a perfectly fair reference, because we were all taught this. But there was a rather obscure poet called William Edward Hickson, who lived from 1803 to 1870, and he wrote a little poem. "'Tis a lesson you should heed, try again. If at first you don't succeed, try again." And again, I've been totally unable to find anyone earlier than Mr. Hickson for doing this. 1 out of 2 for Bruce.
He's marvellous. After all these years, he should get his first radio mention. Play a record for him.
And now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, "Actions speak louder than words."
Let me first of all mention a word about the difficulties of finding a new secretary in London these days. I did have a secretary who was with me for 9 years, and then she decided to get married, and I couldn't hold her any longer. So I had to get a new one, and the trouble is there is a terrible shortage, such a shortage of trained secretarial staff in London today that you have to be satisfied with rather maximum qualifications. In fact, the drill is that when you advertise a job, the applicant comes in and you put her in a room which contains a refrigerator and a typewriter. If she can identify the typewriter, she's hired, which is exactly how I got this Griselda. Now, I don't say anything against Griselda, because she's actually very sweet, one of these sort of Carnaby Street dolly birds, you know, with one of those dresses which starts late and finishes early. But she is incurably and ineradicably urban in her outlook. Now, I found this out because it was Frank's birthday coming up, and I wanted to buy him a sundial. But the point was, I didn't want to pay more than 30 shillings for it, because that happened to be the figure I saw on the price label of the birthday present he bought me. A dining room suite. Now, the trouble is, it's very difficult to find a sundial in London. I tramped all round Soho, and I couldn't see one. The only place you can get them is if you go to these auctions that they have in the country of the contents of old country houses. So we went down by train, and it was then on the train that I realized how unfamiliar anywhere out of town was to Griselda. She had her nose absolutely flattened, saying, "Oh, look, trees." Yeah, and this was Willesden Junction. So when we got out at this little village where the auction was, I realized I would really have to clue her up. Anyway, I gave her this £5, and I said, "Now, remember, not a penny over 30 shillings." She said, "Leave it to me." I went off, I sort of mooched around the village for a while, came back 2 hours later, and there she was, triumphantly waving the receipt for the sundial. I said, "That's very good, Griselda, very well done. I don't think there'll be any trouble now about you having Christmas day off." I said, "Now, have you got the change from the £5? And she gave me 2 shillings. So I said to her, "I told you not to go a penny over 30 bob." She said, "I didn't." I said, "Well, where's the other £3.08? She said, "Well, that went to labour and materials." I said, "What do you mean, labour and materials?" She said, well, there was this rather nice elderly gentleman with the corduroy trousers and the straw in his mouth, and he volunteered to fix an electric bulb on it so you could use it at night time." Well, as I've often said before, from each of life's setbacks, we grow a little wiser. And the axiom I learned from this experience, I'd like to share with you, and that is this. No matter how dim a dolly bird may be in London, when she gets into the rural surroundings of a country sale, her mind goes even cloudier. Or as this 1906 proverb doesn't quite actions becloud urban birds.
We shall all look forward to another trip to the country for Griselda. And
We go back to Frankmuir, and his quotation, if you remember, was, "If at first you don't succeed, try again."
I have a word of explanation to those of our listeners in the area of Thorpe, Egham, Chertsey, Virginia Water, Staines, who are listening to this on their transistor radios. An explanation of why the electricity has been cut off. So people who haven't got transistor radios won't be listening to this. The reason is very simple, because I didn't read the lettering on the side of the damn thing, you see, and there it was as plain as anything. If one doesn't read what the manufacturers say, there's going to be trouble, isn't there? You see, the trouble was that my dog had got fleas and would need a bath. Now, she's only 18 months and has never faced up to what a bath entails, so I use cunning. That's what makes man superior to a beast, you see, you can outthink them. So I waited for her evening brush, and she got up on the table outside in the garden, and I had secreted behind my back the hose, you see, with a little plastic tap on the end of it. And I brushed her with my left hand, and when her eyes were closed with ecstasy, I produced rapidly the hose, switched the plastic tap on, and out came the water. You have never, to my dying day, I will never forget the look the hound gave me. Sort of utter incredulity. He couldn't understand why water had suddenly attacked her. So she jumped off, and you can't catch an Afghan, 30 knots they do. The lawn's firm. Then watching the newsreel, about a week later, I suddenly saw those water cannon the police use against rioters. And I thought, that's it. That's it. If I can hire a water cannon anywhere in the garden, I'll just follow her and train the thing on her. Where do you get a water cannon? West Berlin, Japan. And then just right with a farm in our village, Mr. Lemprew's farm, and passing it one day, I suddenly saw he had a gadget, an electric gadget plugged into the house with a long lead. It was sort of pipes, and one pipe was in a sack of flour or wheat or grass or something, and an electric motor was whirring, and all this wheat and grass was pouring out of a huge pipe about a foot in diameter at the top, and was pouring into the top of his barn. It was sort of blowing this stuff in. I thought, marvellous, just it. May I borrow that? Yes, of course, said he. Back it came, end in the water butt, leaving end in the water butt, switch on. It would not be hyperbole to describe what happened as a blinding flash. It was an enormous flash of electricity, and all the neon signs outside all the betting shops in West Surrey went out. And that is why I must apologise to those of you who haven't got any current, because I fused the mains. Mr. Lemke came roaring across and said, "You can't use water on that thing. It fused the thing." I said, "Well, how was I to know, Lemke?" With some asperity. I said, "I'm no farmer." This thing's meant for blowing corn and wheat into a barn. It doesn't even work when the stuff's damp. I said, "How am I expected to use it?" "Know that man?" He said, "It's printed on the side of that damn thing." And it was. Really, in rather humiliatingly large letters. It said, and I remember, it said, "Important, you don't succeed. Try drier grain."
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frankmuir wins the contest of two stories, and as a result of that, the entire My Word contest is won by Frankmuir and Dillispower by one half mark, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frankmuir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.